This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up today on the show, Doug Hamilton visits with musician Ilana Peterson. She is from North Dakota, but now calls New York her home, where she founded the Double Reed Ensemble, the New York Kammermusiker, and they are about to embark on their annual tour across the state. Horticulturist Ron Smith will stop by with some timely garden advice. But first, we are going to start with Kathleen Murphy, who is the founder of the CAFE Coalition, and that stands for the Constitutional Amendment for Equality, and that group later rolled into the Equal Rights Amendment Minnesota Coalition, and she is an active member of that group trying to get an Equal Rights Amendment passed in the state of Minnesota with the goal of getting it passed in the federal constitution. Kathleen, thank you for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me.
And I should say Kathleen joins us by phone from St. Paul. Kathleen, give us a little bit of history about this legislation. This goes back at least to 1923.
Yes, it was first introduced by Alice Paul back after women had finally gained the right to vote. She introduced this, I think, maybe 2 years later. It actually been supported by numerous presidents, but not fully pushed in any way up until kind of the '60s revolution, and then it was introduced in Congress in 1972 and passed with overwhelming majority in both bodies of Congress, and then was taken to the states to ratify. Within 5 years, we had gotten 35 states to ratify. To get to the two-thirds majority, you needed 38. So they were three states short come 1977. And the interesting part about this amendment is that it was one of only two constitutional amendments that were given kind of an arbitrary timeline that it had to be ratified within a certain period of time. And initially, it was only given 7 years to ratify. So back when they kind of stalled out at 35 states, Congress under President Jimmy Carter actually extended the timeline by another 3 years to make it a 10-year timeline, and still couldn't get the additional three states because by then Phyllis Schlafly and the Eagle Forum had kind of come out against it and kind of given a number of kind of false claims of what the ERA would lead to. At the same time, back in 1980, Ronald Reagan was the first president to openly oppose it, and the whole Republican Party took it off the platform. So then it was defeated at the end of that second deadline in 1982, and by then people were kind of discouraged, and it had gotten linked to abortion rights issues. Kind of, I would argue, kind of, inappropriately linked. And so then in Minnesota, Minnesota tried then to bring a constitutional amendment into the state constitution starting in 1983. And it's been introduced in every legislative session since then. And it's only got hearings in committees probably about three times. And I think I've been the one to push the three times that it's gotten a hearing. So that's kind of hopefully a brief enough history of the Equal Rights Amendment state and at least in Minnesota.
Well, you've mentioned a couple things that you say it sort of got unfortunately linked with or maybe just linked with a little too heavily is maybe a better term there. But what does it actually say? What are we going for here?
It's only like 24
it's
words.
Short.
It's equality of rights under the law shall not be abridged or denied on account of sex.
So why do you think this hasn't passed in all these years?
Well, like I say, there's many reasons in the 70s. Quickly, let me grab some notes and kind of say kind of what the scare tactics were. It was kind of rumored that women would be forced to work outside of the home, that men would not, have to take care of their families. Women would be forced into the military and enforced into military combat, no less. There's also this notion that is still prevalent, this false notion that existing labor laws actually protected women by saying that, women couldn't be required to perform work that, lifted so much weight or did this kind of thing. But in actuality, it was prohibitions on allowing women to do certain kinds of work. But in the 70s, it was flipped on its head, saying that, that these were, you know, protections for women. And then also one of the bigger issues in the 70s, too, was the insurance lobby. And if you look at the states that, that couldn't get it ratified, that really tried, were like Florida, Illinois, Missouri, and North Carolina. And I believe it was those four states that had the heaviest insurance companies that, that, you know, worked, you know, that kind of dealt with, nationwide insurance. But, yeah, it was the those lobbies that, that thought that insurance would be, you know, they wouldn't be able to charge different amounts for, you know, either car insurance or health insurance or anything like that. So that was, like I say, one of the big organizational efforts to help defeat it as well.
You mentioned that in the 70s, after it was introduced by Congress and supported there and then sent to the states for ratification, needed 38 for majority, got 35 before the deadline. Since then, Nevada and Illinois have ratified it. In fact, recently, Nevada, March of 2017, and Illinois earlier this year. So we are up to 37. Right. Does that mean that at 38, it is officially ratified in the U.S. Constitution, or because these last couple states came in so long after the deadline, is there sort of a reset here? What's the latest on that?
Well, it would need to go to Congress. Congress would need to similar to what they did in 1979, I guess it was, because it was. Forgive my timeline. Similar to back then, they were able to extend the deadline. And I think Congress, or many people think, that Congress could do that now. Because, again, there were only two constitutional amendments that ever had this kind of timeline written into. It wasn't written into the actual, you know, amendment itself. It was written into kind of the preamble or whatever in Congress. So that became an argument, actually, in 1998, I believe it was, when there was a constitutional amendment that took 203 years to ratify. And this is a constitutional amendment on congressional pay raises. So if a constitutional amendment on that could take 203 years to ratify, something regarding human rights should be allowed to take longer than 10 years. So that's the argument there, that it as long as Congress would approve of or accept the 38 ratifications, then it could be considered, the next constitutional amendment.
Why is there an awareness campaign going on right now in Minnesota and in other states? In Minnesota, at least, there have been some billboards put up on some of the strategically placed highways, I should say.
Yes. Well, in Minnesota, like I say, we want to do our part to raise awareness about, you know, that we never got a federal constitutional amendment passed that secures freedom from discrimination. And similarly, in Minnesota, we were never able to get it into the Minnesota Constitution. So while we have, you know, laws that have, you know, come so far, it's still to a lot of us, it's a basic respect issue, that if people truly feel that you know, both genders are equal, then it should be in the kind of, you know, the bedrock founding documents of our state and, of course, of our nation. So since we can't do anything, Minnesota can't really do anything about, helping, you know, ratify. I mean, we already did that in 1973. What we can do, though, is look at our own constitution and lead by example in that way. So that's the effort then that the women of Minnesota that I'm working with are trying to do, is raise awareness on both levels.
You first became active in terms of trying to get this passed around 2009. What have you seen in your tenure working with this in terms of response? Has it been steadily climbing? Has it been up and down? Do you still face a lot of opposition?
No, it's actually getting much better. And I will clarify, too, that I actually first started working on it in 2002. There was another effort that I put forward called the Women's Rights Action Coalition, kind of in response to some elections that occurred in Minnesota. And it was with the intent of bringing back the ERA, because of it just kind of took a different turn. And it was through those discussions between 2002 and 2009 that, like I say, a lot of legislators had told me that they didn't like the term ERA, because they felt that people would just be turned off by it, that it was something from the 70s that no one would pay attention, nobody wanted to bring it up again. So starting with that, you know, 10 plus years ago to now, and of course with, you know, the Me Too movement and so much, you know, Year of the Woman with so many women running for office and all that kind of thing, I think we've seen a huge resurgence this year in recognizing how much, you know, sexual harassment and sexual discrimination there is. And that's kind of what we've been saying all along. So it's kind of like a lot of people's eyes have been opened up to recognize that the, you know, assumed equality is not enough. We really should be paying attention to, you know, our laws. And again, I'll emphasize a constitutional amendment can't be overturned, whereas laws either in, you know, in federal level or in the state level can be overturned by a simple majority.
Okay. So, yeah, because a lot of people do wonder if this really isn't relevant anymore, that we have enough of these protections built into other laws that are on the books.
A lot of people don't understand that the biggest issue that this could help is discrimination in the court system. Things like race, religion, and national origin are held to what's called a strict standard in the court system. So when it comes to discrimination, so therefore laws all across the country can be kind of referred to, you know, case precedent in various, you know, various ways. Whereas gender discrimination is only at an intermediary scrutiny level. So therefore, you know, laws in one state don't apply in another, and even within, you know, court jurisdictions. So it's kind of hard to explain that and for people to understand that, but it's an issue with taking sex discrimination cases to court. It would be certainly bolstered if we had that same protection in our constitutions.
You mentioned earlier in the conversation that there was some hesitation and there was some actually strong opposition in the 70s, even from other women who ran campaigns that were called Stop ERA, and STOP was standing for Stop Taking Our Privileges, and basically saying that they didn't want to be drafted into the military and other kinds of opposition to that. Do you see that kind of opposition to this bill today?
Well, there is still some of that. I did see just in the last couple months that Phyllis Schlafly's daughter has kind of picked up her mantle in the same vein, basically kind of saying that, you know, women already have it so well that we don't need this. That kind of rhetoric, which I guess, you know, I'll still say that, you know, women should be able to, you know, participate in society fully as any other member of society, and so I don't see any scare tactics that have come to fruition that they said in the 70s, and I can't see that anything would happen if this were, you know, put fully into the Constitution. And I think what we've seen by polling over the years is that, you know, 75%+ of people already assume that we have this in the Constitution.
Well, and I will admit that I was one of those people who was surprised to learn that this isn't in the Constitution. And back when this was getting passed, Minnesota was one of the states that did ratify it to help the federal effort, North Dakota also. Are you working with states now like North Dakota to try and get this adopted on the state level?
We're aware of efforts going on in other states. I have to say, personally, I've been focusing more on Minnesota because this is a volunteer job, and we've kind of done a lot of work in raising money and trying to get our own billboards up in our state. But I do know that I believe it was Maine that just recently brought up a state constitution in their legislature. I have to say that I haven't followed to see whether it was passed, but I do know that there's efforts in other states. I'm just not familiar with where. But we would certainly be open to working with other states and providing, you know, any information that we have that kind of helps explain why it's necessary, and of course any strategies that we have, we would certainly be happy to work with people, work with other states.
Are there differences in the wording or in the protections between a state version of the amendment and the federal version?
Well, in Minnesota, there is not.
Okay.
I do have some research on how it's worded or how it's been proposed in other states. So it isn't equal across the board in other states. And there were many states, I can look, see, 22 other states added an equal rights amendment to their own constitution. And actually, it goes back even to the 1800s. Let's see, California, Wyoming, and Utah actually all had constitutional amendments for that protected gender in their constitutions when they formed as a state, and that was to try and get women to move west back in the late 1800s. Hmm. So, like I say, I can go on many tangents about this, but 22 states have their own equal rights amendments, and I would say there's probably not one that is exact to another. But Minnesota's does just use the exact wording of the federal ERA.
And Minnesota is trying to get this on the November 2018 ballot. What do you need for that to happen?
Well, we lost that battle in May when our legislative body adjourned for the season. They did not give us a hearing and did not give us a floor vote to try and get it on the ballot. So our reaction to that is we're making this into an election issue. So we're working with all the candidates out there to try and get them to agree to support this so that it could get on the ballot in 2020 if we haven't already gotten it passed at the federal level.
Kathleen Murphy is a member of the Equal Rights Amendment Minnesota Coalition. She is also the founder of the CAFE Coalition. That stands for Constitutional Amendment for Equality. That's actually the organization that later got folded into the ERA Minnesota Coalition. And she joined me by phone from St. Paul. Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up next, lawsuits over manure from Harvest Public Media.
Looking for something cool on a Thursday night?
The Moth is all about true stories told live.
Then check out the Moth Radio Hour.
Our founder, George Stoss Green, grew up on St. Simon's Island off the coast of Georgia.
The Moth's artistic director, Catherine Burns.
He and his friends would sit around on a porch and play poker and tell stories deep into the night. And there was actually a hole in the screen, and the moths would flutter around, and they started calling themselves the Moths. They would say, "The Moths will meet tonight." And he was so inspired by these nights that when he moved to New York City, he decided to try to recreate these feelings. So he invited 100 friends to his house and invited 5 people to come tell first-person true stories in front of his friends, and that was the very first Moth. And 20 years later, we are now producing more than 600 shows a year. Each of our radio shows pull stories from the Moth's many different programs. We also have a main stage, which does 40 shows a year, touring around the country. And then we have more than 600 monthly open mic story slams that happen around the world. So all of those stories go into a pool, and out of those, we try to craft really beautiful hours. I hope Prairie Public listeners will be willing to check out The Moth. Part of why I think The Moth is so special is you're really hearing from the person it happened to. I mean, so often on TV and even on public radio, the news gets filtered. You're hearing about it through a reporter, or you're hearing somebody who witnessed it tell from the outside. When you're listening to The Moth, you're hearing the story directly from the source, and there's something so thrilling about that.
Thursday at 8 Central and Sunday afternoon at 2.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. People who live next to large livestock operations sometimes sue their neighbors over strong manure smells and air quality issues. But a successful lawsuit in North Carolina showed how to go after the meat companies instead. Harvest Public Media's Madeline Beck explains how that could affect the future of contract livestock operations.
It was a cool day after a light rain. The smell wasn't too strong, but it was definitely there. This is Rob Ewalt's farm, just outside Davenport, Iowa. He grows crops, raises cows, and as you heard, hogs, about 2,500 of them. When pig prices were low in the 90s, he shifted from raising his own hogs to doing it for Eichelberger Farms. That's known as contract growing, when farmers sign an agreement to raise a company's animals for a certain amount of time for a certain amount of money.
This is about the most steady income that we can have is through our contract feeding of hogs.
And Ewalt has stuck by the family-owned Iowa company for the last 20 years.
They're really good people to work for, and we have a good relationship with them.
Contract growing is common in livestock operations, ranging from cows to poultry, and it's how about 44% of U.S. hogs are grown. It's not clear how much a farmer gets paid for contract growing because their agreements with large companies aren't public. But no matter the money, farmers are responsible for maintaining the barns and other animal facilities, facilities that are smelly and can be hazardous to neighbors' health. Neighbors used to sue the farmers directly over that. But a new model worked recently in North Carolina. Blame the company, not the farmer. And this wasn't just any company. It was a subsidiary of Chinese-owned Smithfield Foods, the U.S.'s largest pork producer. The federal jury said Murphy Brown was at fault for polluting the air with strong odors and manure particles and awarded the neighbors more than $50 million, though it was later reduced to $3 million. Now there's 25 similar lawsuits in North Carolina trying to do the same.
The company very closely regulates and dictates what happens on these individual farms.
That's Michelle Nolan. She's a Duke law professor and heads the school's environmental law and policy clinic. She says if there are enough of these types of lawsuits, it could force companies to make sure facilities are upgraded. And to get farmers to do the upgrades, companies may have to pay more. While the North Carolina suit didn't set a national precedent, experts like North Carolina State University's Andrew Brannan believe this kind of lawsuit could work in other livestock-heavy states.
They've now gotten a jury award against, you know, a major livestock integrator.
Brannan, who teaches about ag law, says other major hog-producing states like Iowa, Illinois, and Minnesota don't have strict caps like North Carolina on how much companies could have to pay in court. So lawyers might be more likely to go after companies in the Midwest because they know they could get bigger payouts.
My reaction is I just hate lawsuits.
Ewalt, the contract grower, says the farmer should usually be held liable for nuisances because the farmer owns the facilities. He acknowledges that hog farming doesn't smell great.
We're not growing roses. It's not going to smell like roses.
But Ewalt has kept his neighbors in mind, putting up windbreaks to keep the smell from drifting and siphoning the manure straight from the pit under the hogs and injecting it into fields. These types of changes are expensive. In Iowa, there are strict manure disposal laws that don't allow for lagoons of liquefying manure like there are in North Carolina. But in any state, ponying up for other smell reductions may not be worth it for big operations. And Ewalt said if large companies don't pay enough to contractors,
then it's hard to make upgrades. It costs a lot of money to upgrade these.
Without upgrades, overwhelming smells will stick around and neighbors may try to sue. But this time, they're liable to go after the massive meat company. Madeline Beck, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaborative focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. Reporting from America's heartland. Coming up on Main Street, Doug Hamilton talks with a Double Reed musician about to launch a tour in North Dakota. That's after this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A new study concludes that North Dakota ranks toward the bottom of the list when it comes to safety for teen drivers. The study was released by personal finance website WalletHub, which ranks North Dakota 45th out of 50 states and their conditions for teen drivers. When it comes to overall safety, North Dakota is 46th. North Dakota is 26th for economic environment and 39th when it comes to driving laws. North Dakota's AAA spokesman Gene LaDucer says the numbers might not seem that encouraging, but he remembers last year's study and says since then there has been improvement. He says there has been a significant decrease in the number of crashes for North Dakota's youngest licensed drivers, and stricter laws have helped in that area. But he says older teens tend to crash more.
Those with a little more experience behind the wheel, but perhaps are picking up some bad driving habits. Well, specifically for that age group, we see a lot of speeding, driving too fast for conditions, distractions using their electronics while driving behind the wheel. Alcohol use starts to creep into that age group. And unfortunately, we see that age group as being one of the worst for wearing their seat belts. So when they are involved in a crash, oftentimes it's a serious crash or a fatal crash.
LaDucer says one step in the right direction might be to make licensing laws for younger drivers more consistent.
If you start at age 14, you go through one process. If you're 15, you go through a different process. And if you're 16 or older, you go through an entirely different process. If we could make that process consistent across all age groups would be easier to understand, easier to enforce, easier for parents to enforce, and that would help reduce crashes.
For the older age groups, LaDucer says it's a matter of understanding and enforcing laws. For example, he says having a primary seatbelt law in North Dakota for all drivers of all ages would make it much easier to enforce. And University of North Dakota's officials say it took months of talks and development, but a new partnership is being rolled out between the university and United Airlines. Jim Higgins is chairman of the aviation department at UND.
The idea was we needed to keep some flight instructors here for a little bit of time so that they can teach our incoming students and kind of create this ecosystem. And then once those students are ready to move on, they move on to United, one of their partners, either ExpressJet, Commuter, Mesa, or Air Wisconsin. And then after about two and a half years there, they get to go right directly to United Airlines. And that's a pretty tremendous, right out of college, you're going to probably get a $80,000 to $90,000 a year job, and then two and a half years later, you'll go right to your final airline.
Higgins says the partnership is a very proactive step. He says United is looking forward and seeing an increased demand for new pilots over the next 5 to 10 years.
And that it's going to be very, very difficult to maybe find enough people to meet that need. So they've come to the largest aviation school in the United States here at UND and made a pretty bold move, in my opinion.
Higgins says it's believed that the major airlines will need to hire about 24,000 people over the next 10 years. He says right now there are only 18,000 pilots with regional carriers. Higgins says the partnership with United and UND will help fill the gap to avoid serious shortages along the way. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I'm in studio with Ilana Peterson. She is the director of the New York Kammermusiker, and they're planning another trip to North Dakota, their 12th annual Winds of Change Festival in August. Thanks for being with us, Ilana.
Well, thank you.
Give our listeners just that brief history of what the Kammermusiker is and how it got started.
Well, it started almost 50 years. Actually, next year is our 50th year anniversary, and it began as not as a double reed group as we are now, but a larger group, octets, and it went to quintets, and then it went to winds and strings. And when I went to play in Germany, I married an oboist. So now we're all double reeds.
And so describe the sound of what you do for our listeners.
It's,
and we'll play a little bit in a minute.
Yes. Well, it's very much like choral music. And in fact, it's the closest to choral music sound, I think, with any instruments. And it's a full sound. Well, I think we'll just listen.
Let's listen to a sample here. Here's Courante Scheidt. How many people are playing there?
You wouldn't believe it, but there's only four of us.
That's a lot of music.
It's a very full sound. It's two oboes, one English horn, one bassoon.
Well, let's get to the personal history here, Ilana. Why do you come to North Dakota every year?
Because I'm a native North Dakotan, I guess.
That's a great
reason. Actually, we have two members that are originally from North Dakota. One's Mark is from Bismarck. He plays with the Minnesota Orchestra and St. Paul Chamber. He also plays in Chicago with the Baroque Orchestra now. And I studied with Alma Mayo Studios, so that's the connection to the music part of this.
So Kammermusiker has been around 50 years. You've been playing in North Dakota, these Winds of Change festivals.
Well, just the last 12 years.
For 12 years, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this concert series coming up, the performances in August, start Friday, August 10th, and go through, what is it?
August 14th.
Tuesday, August 14th. So
mm-hmm.
You're going to be all over the state or good parts of
Pretty close to Fargo this year.
Fargo, Ellendale,
Ellendale's in the south.
Yeah, there you go. But you're going to be doing concerts in lots of places, including Chehinkapa Zoo.
Of course. That's one of our members is Tall, the orangutan there. This will be his third annual concert with us, and he does – he's great.
What does he play?
He plays recorder.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And how does he play?
You know, he picked up the blowing aspect, so just like that, naturally. I mean, that's hard to do if you are not a musician or have it. He just learned. He watched us, and the rhythms too. He picks up rhythms.
So that's got to be entertaining for the folks who go to that concert at Chahinkapazoo, and that's on Tuesday, August 14th. They'll see the orangutan performing with the New York Kammermusiker. So I assume you've done this more than once, right?
This is a third year,
okay. And
we're anxious for it too.
Now, the Kammermusiker, describe how it is comprised. Who are the musicians? Are they always the same ones?
Well, they're basically always the same ones when we have the big, big group playing. When we tour, because of airfares, of course, we have to cut the size down, which doesn't, as you see, doesn't really affect the sound of the group at all.
No.
I mean, four people is pretty strong. I think that a couple of us are always with the group, but then we have to rotate. Now, this year we have our Mexican State Orchestra member coming in, and he has to arrive in Fargo early because he's got to work on the reeds, the mouthpieces of our instruments. They're made from cane, and they don't vibrate. He's playing at 9,000 feet above sea level, and he comes here to, what, below sea level?
Well, not too far above it at any rate. Yeah. And so he's got to adjust the reeds for this particular altitude?
Yes, uh-huh. Okay. So it's a complete different reed that he comes up with. And he's great. He's from Philadelphia originally.
Well, let's listen to another sample of the New York Kammermusiker. This is the suite from The Fairy Queen, The Monkey's Dance. Again, a lot of sound coming from a few people.
And that's four people in that.
This tour always has an element of history, doesn't it?
Yes. Every year it's different. History related to the area or related to whatever is going on at that time of year.
And your son has accompanied you before, and this time he's going to be performing as...
Well, he'll help us out with Theodore Roosevelt topic, which we're trying to do a lot of history. And by the way, next year in Medora, they're going to have Theodore Roosevelt special program, and I'm hoping that we can make it at that time.
Well, yeah, he usually shows up at Medora because, of course, that's TR country.
That's
there.
Right.
There's also another kind of a historical connection here. You reminded me that George Custer, who was sort of famous for a battle he lost, liked music?
He brought in a famous Italian bandmaster to lead his bands at the Fort Abraham Lincoln before he went on to Bighorn.
Yeah, and the demise. And so this would have been the guy's name was Felix Vinatieri.
That's right.
He would have been in the middle of kind of nowhere for somebody, wouldn't he?
It's very interesting how great artists were brought to North Dakota. Always, I think.
Oh.
I mean, even my grandmother, when she came from Norway, we attended all these Norwegian log meetings, and everybody sang. There was a whole tradition that was here already when they homesteaded.
How is the New York Kammermusiker supported?
Well, we call it by friends.
Okay.
And it really, you know, we love to play, and we'll just make it happen, whatever the circumstance is. But we have a lot of friends all over the world now.
You've got plenty of supporters. There's a sheet here. We can't mention all of the names,
no.
But there are a couple dozen here.
Yeah, I think they're more friends. I walked off the plane yesterday, went to a restaurant, and the manager came running out. Oh, you're back. You're back. And she wanted to hear us play. So, I mean, these are friends.
And you do these special concerts. You're going to be at, for example, Chahinkapazoo, we've mentioned. You're going to be at the historic Ellendale Opera House in Ellendale early in that tour. And you're also going to go to the Vets Home in right?
That's right. That's new.
Is that in Wahpeton?
No, this is in Lisbon. It's North Dakota's only vet home, I believe. And the reason we wanted to go there this year is because we had a 98-year-old former surgeon that took up oboe and played with us once a year. He was from Wahpeton. Everybody knows him, the Dr. ER. And he was a vet. And when I called the vets home, I said that, you know, that he had played with us. And, of course, they want us to come. So it'll be a different experience for us, but also we'll be bringing them a one-on-one experience. They'll be able to – and we have special music being prepared for this.
And you're doing special things in other places, too. I know when you're at the First Presbyterian Church in Fargo, you'll be performing with their organist.
Right.
And that's
yes.
Sally Harmon.
That's right. Uh-huh.
So you've got a lot of variety here, and you're going to have how many people? Is it going to be four people this year?
No.
How many is it going to be?
Well, at this moment, we've got 12 musicians coming.
Musicers.
Yes.
Going.
Everyone wants to come. If they've been here once, they want to return. And it's sort of hard to figure out, you know, how can I alternate people because I can't afford everybody.
Well, I'm thinking we've just heard two selections that featured four double
right,
reed players.
Right.
And that's a big sound. Imagine 12.
That's right.
Well, let's listen to one more example here. This is Water Music from Handel. This is Air.
And this is bigger group.
Okay. Wow, when they all come in, they come in.
Yeah, that's right. I started that one. I was the English horn. But that's with timpani.
Yeah,
and
you got percussion in this thing.
Right, right. Two English horns, two oboes, or three oboes, I don't remember, and multiple bassoons and contrabassoons.
So that's the kind of sound people are going to hear this time around?
I hope so. Yes.
Well, the New York Kammermusiker is coming to North Dakota for the 12th time. This is the Winds of Change Festival, and we've had Ilana on here before talking about this marvelous musical experience that you can experience yourself. It starts in Fargo on August 10th. It goes to Ellendale, Enderlin, Lisbon, back in Fargo, then to Breckenridge and Wahpeton, and you finish up on Tuesday, August 14th. So 5 days of lots of music.
That's right, and we love it.
All right. Ilana Peterson, always a pleasure to have you
well,
with us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
More Main Street in a moment.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and in studio with me now is horticulturist Ron Smith. Ron, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure, always.
We have you in periodically during the growing season for our many questions about our wonderful lawns and gardens. And heads up to our listeners, Wednesday the 20th, start thinking about your questions now because Ron will be in live that day. So get ready to email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or you'll be able to call 888-755-6377. Again, that is coming up Wednesday the 20th. Ron?
And we love questions.
We do love questions.
Yeah, otherwise, we just start talking back and forth to each other. And,
yeah, and that's
you know, we love fresh questions.
There's only so long I can just talk to Ron, you guys.
Yeah,
so
I believe that, yeah.
So what are the things that we should be working on here? We're just at the very end of early June. We're heading into mid-June, into full-on summer here.
Well, yeah, warm weather is definitely here. So if you're into vegetable gardening, which a lot of people seem to be these days, and that's good because you can go ahead and plant snap beans, pole beans. Those are warm season crops that love the heat. You know, the one thing that we've had is we've had hot weather leading up to this point in time. And that hot weather has heated the soil. And that heated soil acts as a root stimulant for these plants to get established very, very quickly. So if you put the seed in, you seed directly with beans, corn, sweet corn, things like a cabbage, you can go ahead and do this with. The other, any crop that requires warm season, melons, watermelons, cantaloupe melons, they will go ahead and take off very, very quickly for you and be productive coming this fall, this September, actually. So this is a good time to go ahead and do something like that.
And this is actually from seed, or this is put in the ground, anything you've started?
You can do either one. If you have starters,
okay,
it'll work faster. If you have direct seed, and my wife has sown some direct seeded melons and muskmelons, watermelons and muskmelons, and they're coming up, popping up already. We did it this is Tuesday, but she did it Friday, and they are popping up already with that warm soil temperature that we have. So it's great. It's good.
Yeah.
Perfect.
It is, and you mentioned corn and bean, and I know corn, bean, and squash are often referred to as the three sisters in some indigenous traditions. They grow well together. They complement each other. But I think it was you who told me that you don't just plant them near each other. You actually can plant those
can
all in
it.
The
I've,
same
I've
hole.
I've done that. I tried that when I was working with the Extension Service, and it works out very well. The corn pops up and grows.
Mm-hmm.
Beans or peas that you want to go ahead and put in there, we'll go ahead and vine around.
What are you doing after the show today?
Yeah, what did I have for lunch, right? Vine around the corn, and they just kind of complement each other. So you've got this mound or this hill that you can go ahead and make your harvest from as the season goes on.
And they all taste delicious together. Another thing we should be doing this time of year, deadheading, is
that
right?
Deadheading, yeah, deadheading. If you have tulips that bloom, they'll be working on setting seed now, so go ahead and get that cut back. Don't take the leaves off yet because they're still green and producing photosynthates, which go into the bulb, which will give you flowers for next year. The common lilacs have finished blooming. They also are setting seeds, so if you can go ahead and cut those back to the next viable green shoot, that'll be fine because they won't be putting needless energy into seed maturation, and we'll be able to put it into new flower bud development for next year. Let's see what else. We've got things coming into bloom that are looking spectacular now. There's nine bark, the Diablo nine bark, appropriately named because it's a deep maroon colored leaf, beautiful, beautiful leaf with beautiful white flowers. And the thing I like about it, it's tolerated the ravages of the rabbit so far these last couple of years, and it's come back very nicely for us. So that's a good thing to go ahead and have. I want to try to encourage people to plant butterfly weed, which you asked me about some time ago. You can get the seed or
the swamp
better yet,
milkweed.
It'll attract the butterflies. There's another one that called the Joe Pie weed, which is a perennial. Gets to be about 6 feet tall and produces beautiful, attractive flowers to the pollinators, hummingbirds, as well as the butterflies. So look to those to be, you can go ahead and still plant them, and they'll come back for you again next year.
Yeah, pollinator garden's so important. And I'll just mention here, too, that in my research on the pollinator plant specific to the monarch butterflies, you do need to be careful to plant the exact right species of milkweed because they will only lay their eggs on one specific kind.
Yep.
So do your research. I don't remember the name beyond
I don't remember the name
milkweed,
either. But
I know there was a special Latin name.
Asclepias. I'm sorry, I can't remember what the species is. But usually if you get your seed from a wildflower source, or it's listed in a wildflower mixture, that will be the right species to go ahead and attract the butterflies that they can also lay their eggs on and have the larvae feed. So you want caterpillars in that sense.
I want to go back to talking about lilacs, because you mentioned now is a good time to start cutting them back.
Mm-hmm.
If I recall correctly, you've said with trees that you don't want to cut off any more than 25% to 30% of the tree at any given time. Does that apply to lilacs?
Well, let me just address common lilacs.
Okay.
They are tougher than a warthog to kill. I mean, they are just incredible plants. I've taken lilacs and cut them right back to 3-inch stubs, and they come back with a vengeance. So that might be the exception as far as cutting plants back. Yeah, you can cut them back a third, a quarter, half. They'll keep coming back for you, well-established lilacs. In fact, one of the things I both like and don't like about common lilacs is that they spread. You plant a nice, innocent-looking shrub in one spot, It grows and blooms beautifully at 5 to 6 feet the first year. The next year, it's 8 to 10. The third year is 12 feet. And that one spot has spread out to about 5 to 6 feet in width. You get new suckers coming up. And eventually, it's going to take over the spot that you put it in. Now, that might be fine if you want a screen, a solid screen. But if you're in a typical residential area, you're going to have problems with that creeping into your neighbor's property, creeping into your garden, your vegetable garden, providing too much shade for your garden to grow successfully, having competition from the roots. So, you know, be careful with the decision you make with your common lilacs. Now, there's a lot of other cultivars of lilacs out there that you can grow that'll get to be about 5 to 6 feet tall and stay at that height. And the Miss Kim is a very conspicuous one that does a beautiful job growing, producing nice little flowers, stays within bounds, so it makes a very good residential landscape plant.
Okay. What should we be doing with tulips right now besides saying, thank you for being here, we'll see you again next year?
Tulips, you can just leave them if you want to. You can dig them out if you don't like where they are and move them to a new location once the foliage has yellowed on you.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other things that you could do would be to dig them out, hold them, and then come this fall, plant them amongst some daffodils because the rabbits don't like daffodils. And so the daffodils will act as a protectant for the tulips. They're kind of the armed guards for the tulips. Now, don't ask me. I see that question forming in your head. How do the rabbits know the difference between a tulip and a daffodil? I have no idea how they communicate, but they seem to know the difference.
And as a reminder to our listeners, Ron Smith will be live on Wednesday the 20th, so you can email your questions now, mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. We do have a question from our producer, Skip, who brought in a small section of his elm tree.
Mm-hmm.
And says it is shedding all of the ends of all of the limbs. Mm-hmm. And seems to be very specifically at one certain joint.
Mm-hmm.
Of the elm. What's going on
well,
here?
Well, that's an insect called a twig girdler, appropriately named, because that's exactly what it does. And, you know, I just wonder, you know, it's acting mischievously or it's doing it for food purposes or to lay eggs. It obviously must lay eggs somewhere. But, you know, I've seen this happen, and bingo, it's like somebody has rained the area with twig ends.
It's like raking in June.
All over the place, and it makes a heck of a mess, and it scares the daylights out of the tree owner. So nothing to worry about. Don't get out your insecticide. They're going to come and go. They're going to fade, and it's not going to hurt the tree, I promise you. That if that kills a tree, then there's something else wrong with the tree besides that. So,
is there any need for any kind of fertilizer right now? I know sometimes
a perfect question.
Seasonal.
Thank you. That's a perfect question. I was going to talk about that anyway. If you fertilized early in the spring, which would have been about 6 weeks ago, okay, back in the beginning of May, that's good because the grass had begun active growth, so it'll help stimulate the grass to go ahead and grow. But if you know, I'm assuming it was not over-fertilized, but fertilized normally at the normal rate of about a half a pound per 1,000 square feet, you can go ahead between now, the middle of June, until around the 4th or 5th of July, and put on another fertilizer application if you're not in a drought situation. If you're in a droughty situation here in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Minnesota, don't fertilize until you see or know some rain is in the immediate forecast. Because if you put fertilizer down, it's like stocking your pantry with canned foods, but you don't have a can opener. It's not going to do it any good. And it's probably going to help to burn or salt affect that lawn. So if you can do a light fertilization, about a quarter to a half a pound per 1,000 square feet, water it in if you're not in water restrictions, or do it just before a rainstorm hits. So that would be a good thing. As far as other plants go, yes, you can go ahead and give them a shot to help get them through the stresses of summer heat.
All right, Ron, we are out of time. Until next week, thanks.
You're welcome.
And reminder, Ron is live Wednesday the 20th right here on Main Street. Dakota Datebook is next.
Before highways, there were trails. North Dakota has 10 scenic byways, and the longest one is the Old Red Old 10 Scenic Byway between Mandan and Dickinson. The drive features a slower pace off the interstate while enjoying the rolling hills of ranch and farmland or tracing the footprints of Custer's March West. Learn more about Old Highway 10 and Red Trail at oldredold10.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 12th. Today, people take antibiotics like penicillin and amoxicillin for granted. But it was just back in 1945, during World War II, that the wonder drug called penicillin first came to North Dakota. Penicillin's discovery came from Alexander Fleming, born in Scotland in 1881, who studied medicine and served in World War I as a doctor. Later, in 1928, while experimenting with Staphylococcus germs, he observed that mold had accidentally grown upon the germ culture and the mold killed the bacteria that it touched. Fleming named the active element in the mold penicillin. In 1929, he published his findings. Fleming's experimental work was continued by bacterial experts at Oxford University during the 1930s. In World War II, British and American military medical teams initiated major advances by producing massive quantities of penicillin to treat battlefield wounds and tropical diseases. It was on this date, in 1944, that Alexander Fleming informed the public that penicillin was being produced in sufficient doses to help wounded soldiers on the battlefields and would do far more as the supply increased. The wonder drug was first used by U.S. medics in 1943 at the Battle for Tunisia in North Africa. Government-supported laboratories eventually produced penicillin on a vast scale. How did this affect North Dakota? Well, penicillin not only saved the lives of thousands of North Dakota soldiers in World War II, it also came home to the state in 1944 when the War Production Board allowed restricted access to the wonder drug for civilian use. It came to Bismarck in June 1944, with hospitals receiving enough penicillin to treat between 100 and 300 patients. In 1945, the supply improved, and Minot's doctors also gained access to this new discovery. And so penicillin, the miracle medicine found in mold, had arrived in North Dakota's hospitals, bringing hope to those who suffered from dangerous infections. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we visit with author David Osborne, who won the 2018 Spur Award for Historical Fiction from the Western Writers of America. And that award was for the book The Coming, which tells the expansive and tragic story of Native and white relations in the American West. And he tells us through a fictionalized account of the life of Daytime Smoke, the real-life son of a Nez Perce woman, and William Clark from the Lewis and Clark Expedition. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.